Let's have the discussion. You're listening to Canter with Scott and Adam.
Hello and welcome to Canter. I'm Adam Breeze.
And I'm Scott Hillier.
And today we sit down with cannabis industry consultant and journalist Reese Cohen.
Reese tells us about his entry into the cannabis industry, runs us through his past 4 years, including his time at the famous Lambert Initiative, and gives us a taste of his 2021 predictions for the Australian cannabis space.
Enjoy the episode and be sure to follow us on Instagram at Canter Podcast. Let's get into it.
Reese Cohen, thank you very much for joining us, mate.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Reese, tell us a little bit about yourself, mate. You seem to be a jack of all trades. You're a consultant to many. Tell us a bit about your background, how you found yourself in the cannabis space, and what you've been doing in the cannabis space.
All good questions. I guess I am a bit of a jack of all trades to some extent. I mean, that's one of the things that I really like about cannabis is it kind of requires you to keep learning and keep expanding your knowledge into areas that you're very, you know, unfamiliar with. You know, it's not really possible to stay in one spot for too long. You've got to kind of keep swimming. So I'm the editor-at-large for Cannabis, which is Australia's sort of premier industry commentary analysis website. I am also a freelance commercial consultant sit on an advisory board at Freshleaf Analytics, which is a business intelligence and consulting company that works in this space. I'm actually, as of this month, a full-time master's student at the Macquarie University in the discipline of sociology. So I've decided I hate myself so much, I'm actually going to go back to uni, back to poverty, and back to full-time study this year and do a master's by research, looking at the history of medical cannabis legalization in Australia, just trying to, you know, understand it in a bit more depth about how it happened in the way it happened, you know, hopefully uncover some interesting results that can help inform like future drug law reform sort of efforts. That's the aim anyway. We'll see how we go. I've been kicking around in the cannabis space for a few years now. So I got into it when I was at uni, actually. So I went to uni and I did an arts degree. And I majored in a discipline called political economy, which is sort of like looking at economics as a social science as opposed to a mathematical science. I ended up doing my honors thesis on the legalization of cannabis in Colorado. And yeah, trying to look at, you know, why did it happen in that place at that time? You know, how does that relate to what else is going on in America in terms of, you know, their economy and their society and, you know, prison populations and that kind of thing. And at the time I thought, oh, well, you know, I had my fun at uni, you know, finished my honors degree, you know, did it in cannabis. That was fun. I guess I better go get a real job now. I ended up just being in the right place at the right time, essentially. So it wasn't shortly. It was only a few months after that the medical cannabis was legalized in Australia at the federal level in February 2016. And so I was like, okay, well, you know, I'm someone who knows something about cannabis. You know, no one else in Australia knows much about medical cannabis or cannabis. You know, I probably know as much as some other people. So I guess, you know, I should have a crack. So yeah, I just set up a website and started calling myself a consultant. And that was sort of the beginning of the journey. And then since then, I've been involved in a few sort of more long-term engagement. So I set up and ran a business to consumer cannabis education program in 2017 with a company called Can10. Then I moved from that role into I got hired by the Lambert Initiative for Cannabinoid Therapeutics at the University of Sydney. So that's a philanthropically funded medical cannabis research group within the university. And I'm not a scientist or a medico, but they hired me to do essentially like a combination of scientific project management, stakeholder relations, media, policy, just sort of like an everyman kind of role, I guess. And that was terrific and super interesting to get a bit of exposure to the medical science sort of side of things. And then after that, I went back to freelancing for a while. I ended up joining up and running Freshleaf Analytics for about a year. And then I stepped out of that role last year sometime to give myself some space and time to get back into my studies, which is what I'm doing now. So I've kind of done a whole bunch of different stuff now I think about it. And then, you know, in the meantime, you know, done bits and pieces here for here and there for different clients. Often the consulting work that I do is regulatory advice or policy advice or sort of network introductions kind of stuff. You know, helping often overseas companies figure out what's going on in the Australian landscape, you know, who's who in the zoo, who to talk to, that kind of thing. And then in the meantime, you know, I've just been writing and talking until people tell me to shut up. So I've been, you know, on podcasts and, you know, talking at conferences and, you know, writing blogs and all that kind of good stuff. Yeah, which has been a lot of fun, really. So
you write a lot of really good stuff.
Yeah.
So I do urge people to check out Reese's content, because one thing I like about you, you seem to be relatively unbiased and reasonable with your analyses of almost everything in the space. So I think it's awesome that we have someone like you here in Australia that's willing to call out perhaps people that could be future clients of yours, call out malpractice in the industry, call out issues with regulatory sort of red tape. So I find it really cool that even though you're engaging with all of these people, you are still willing to, whilst you aren't naming names, you are willing to go out there and say, hey, this is happening in this industry. I don't agree with it necessarily. What do you think? And I think that's great to have someone like you and a voice like you. Because I don't think we've had that up till now.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah. I'm not, you know, I'm not a crusader for justice or anything like that, but I think really my problem is that I have very strong feelings and a big mouth. So, you know, even if I wanted to, I probably couldn't moderate myself to a greater extent that I'm currently managing. Yeah. And, you know, but I think, yeah, people get it right. Like I've been quite open about, you know, some perfectly legal business strategies, perfectly fine business strategies, you know, that I personally don't agree with. You know, it's not a comment on individuals, or, you know, I'm not saying, you know, people are bad people or whatever. But yeah, I think it's important that, you know, the reason I'm in this industry and have stayed in this industry for so long is because fundamentally I'm really passionate about people getting access to medicine that they need, you know. And I care more about that than I care about saving face, I guess, for the sector. Yeah.
Good call, man. You've been knocking about with a mutual friend, Tom, for pretty much this whole period. How do you know Tom? Mm-hmm. How'd you meet up with him, bud?
Arkell or Forrest?
Actually, both of them. But Forrest, let's go with – I forgot there's two of them. Let's start with Forrest. I think you probably rolled with him from Day Dot in 2016. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, how did I meet Tom? So I guess Tom and I met through Tim Oates and the sort of Delta Tetra consultancy guys, because he's mates with them. They're all Melbourne folks. I think that's how I first met Tom. And then, yeah, we've just stayed in touch ever since. I mean, he's a great guy, obviously a lovely person and quite brilliant. And I'm not at all a plant person. Like I am not even that interested in cannabis botany or cultivation. It's just not something that tickles my fancy necessarily. So it's super handy to have Tom there. That's his whole bag. I mean, like, you know, he does other stuff as well, but, like, you know, cultivation is his thing. And so that's been a really convenient kind of synergy, I guess, you know, because, like, you know, we can draw on each other's expertise, or, you know, call each other up and talk shop. And we come from very different perspectives and we have very different skills, you know. Whenever I go down to Melbourne, you know, we usually bump into each other or catch up. Not much of an opportunity to do that at the moment, but we did see each other in Tassie the other month, I guess it was now. That was nice. Yeah.
Now you mentioned.
And then.
Sorry, man. You mentioned.
No, you go.
Sorry to cut you off, but you mentioned Thomas Arkell as well. And you mentioned your time at the Lambert Initiative. What a wonderful initiative. And what a great bunch of people who are doing fantastic things for the space, and their impact is not just domestic. So what was it like being amongst that that environment where you're amongst all these really great minds with people who are very passionate about what they're doing and are really pioneering certain aspects of research?
yeah, it was extraordinary, really. Like, when I was at the Lambert Initiative, so that sort of January 2018 till mid-2019, I think I was there for about a year and a half, the crew is very young to begin with. Like, most of the scientific staff there are really, like, quite young people, like lots of PhD students, lots of honor students. So it had the most terrific social environment. Like, you know, lots of extroverts, lots of really interesting people who were all in one way or another fascinated by or passionate about drug laws or drug discovery or medicinal cannabis. You know, so that was one thing. And then, of course, you know, you had the scientific leadership team who are, you know, sort of, you know, very, very well credentialed and esteemed scientists in their own right, who'd also been given this mandate that they took really seriously and still take really seriously, the mandate to affect change, you know? So I think that's something that's really unique about the Lambert Initiative is from the outset, the project has always been to further the cause of medicinal cannabis, you know? Now, not blindly, necessarily, but what that allowed was for it meant that some of the priorities for the Lambert Initiative weren't just medical scientific; they were also political. They were regulatory. You know, there was an obligation to contribute to the public discussion on how medical cannabis is accessed and managed in Australia. And you know, as someone who's passionate about that, It was such a privilege to be told, you know, okay, Reese, you know, we want to achieve policy outcome X, you know, try and make it happen or whatever. And, you know, to do that with a .sydney.edu.au email address, you know, it adds a lot of gravitas, I think, to the work that you do. So yeah, it was quite tremendous. It was also really challenging, like, and you know, and not without its own quirks. I guess you could say a lot of big personalities, you know, not just in the Lambert Initiative, but you know, within the university, within the space, you know, there's a lot of cats to herd. But it was a terrific learning experience. I think one of the reasons why I ended up moving on from that position was I'd basically gotten to the point where I felt like I'd learned everything that I could, or I'd done everything that I could without being a medical scientist myself.
Yeah, sure.
You know, because being basically the only non-scientist in a whole organization of scientists doing medical scientific research, eventually, you know, you sort of, well, I started to feel a little bit sort of ornamental, or rather, you know, I didn't feel like I was able to contribute in the same way as my colleagues, you know, were. So
yeah, that's fair enough, I guess.
Yeah. But I still keep in touch with a whole bunch of them. And, you know, the Lambert Initiative is a client of mine from time to time as well. Yeah, it was a good time.
Well played, man. I'm sure it was an amazing experience to be amongst those guys for such a period of time too. And big shout out to Thomas Arkell, who was on our show and has done some great research. And I know there's a whole team of them that need a shout out too. So, yeah, big shout out to the Lambert Initiative. We love you guys. Yeah.
And speaking of you know, world impacting research, like that paper that Tom put out, my God, like that got unimaginable coverage globally, you know, in, you know, dozens of languages, in, you know, really high ranking publications. It was a really well received paper, that one. So
it's rare to see that kudos. Research where you as soon as you start reading it, you go, okay, this is actually going to affect change. And you spoke about that mandate of theirs. So they're clearly following through on it and affecting the change that they're hoping to affect. And what a great piece of what a great change they can affect with that science, because I think that discussion on driving has been one that's on people's tongues for a number of years now. So yeah, just fantastic work. Now, Reese, last year you released some predictions for the year 2020, and I'm going to hit you up. I'm going to put you on the spot, mate. 2021's amongst us. It's January.
Yeah.
I haven't seen your predictions yet.
That's right. I did promise I'd put those out, didn't I? I should work on that.
Do you have anything for us, mate? Do you have some predictions for this coming year? Because I must tell people that last year you pretty much hit almost everything on the head. You nailed it. So you're obviously a man with a finger on the pulse.
7 out of 10.
Yeah, I think 7, and that's being fairly modest, I think, Reece. So you've obviously got your finger on the pulse with the Australian scene, and you have numerous international contacts as well that help you, I guess, sort through the BS. So, mate, what do you think is going to haunt you for this year?
It's going to be an interesting year. I mean, it's always an interesting year, isn't it? So I guess, first of all, you know, patient access and revenue from an industry perspective, that's only going up. That's definitely going to continue on that trajectory this year. You know, where are we going to end up at the end of the year? Not quite sure, but I reckon we could easily double the number of patients that are currently accessing medicinal cannabis within the next 12 months.
So what sort of numbers are we talking?
It's getting really hard to even put a rough figure around that. Yep. You know, best case guess, maybe we finish the year with, you know, 30 to 40,000 Australians actively taking a prescribed cannabis medicine. Mm-hmm. But I reckon, you know, unless something fundamental changes in the way in which patient access happens in Australia, it's basically going to become nearly impossible to provide anything close to a reasonable active patient forecast as time goes on. And, you know, that's because, well, first of all, the estimates that we have at the moment are the best ones that we have available, but they're pretty flimsy estimates, you know, because it's basically you look at the number of special access scheme category B approvals in a given month, and you assume that translates into a certain number of active patients, you know.
Yep.
And that assumption, you know, is full of its own assumptions, which may or may not be reasonable or accurate. You know, it's quite complex, I suppose. But basically, you know, from a special access scheme category B approval, you can assume that, you know, a certain percentage of those approvals are for new patients versus returning patients. Then you have to estimate, okay, well, you know, for new patients, how many of those people will actually fill a prescription, or how many just abandon the approval because they wanted to keep it in their glove box in case they got stopped by the cops or whatever. You know, I don't know what reasons people have, or the price was too expensive. So, and there are plenty of reasons why people won't get a prescription even if they have an approval. You know, then we don't really know how many prescriptions each patient is issued or how many of those they fill, because that data is only captured at the pharmacy level and the government doesn't capture that data and the government doesn't release that data.
Okay.
And then you've got to think about, okay, well, you know, and how often and how many patients, you know, how long will someone who starts taking a cannabis medicine, how long will they continue taking their cannabis medicine for before they stop? So there are so many variables, you know, and that's just estimating things based off the special access scheme approvals, right? And then you've got to remember, okay, well, that's most probably how most people are getting access at the moment. But there's also people getting access via authorized prescribers. And those patient numbers are reported and recorded differently. And there's also an unknown number of patients who are getting compounded medicinal cannabis products. And compounded products, you don't even need a SASB approval. So we have no way of knowing how many people might be getting access to products like that. So this is why, you know, I mean, it's a useful number to try and come up with. I would love there to be a better way to do it or a way that produces a more accurate number. But yeah, at the moment, that's the best we've got. And probably 30 to 50,000, that sounds about right to me. And I reckon we'll double that this year. There's a lot of pent-up demand for prescription medicinal cannabis. There's at least, you know, several hundred thousand Australians who take cannabis illegally only for medical reasons. That's just the low-hanging fruit. You know, there's all the other people who take cannabis sometimes for recreational purposes, sometimes for medical purposes. And then, of course, there's all those people who have never used or don't currently use cannabis, but might if they were recommended it by a doctor, you know. So lots of pent-up demand. And what we're seeing is that demand is being met. So loads of new medical cannabis clinics have come on board last year. I think that's only going to continue into 2021. You know, those clinics are starting to be quite competitive with each other in terms of pricing and, you know, making their services attractive to patients. And that makes it more affordable for patients, which makes it more likely for them to pursue a prescription. Product pricing, you know, has always been expensive. It continues to be expensive, but it's coming down, you know. So, you know, every 6 months, you know, it comes down significantly, like, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50% sometimes. I mean, they can't go on forever necessarily, but it's still got some ways to go, I reckon, you know, product pricing. We're getting to the point now where legally prescribed cannabis medicines are getting close to competing with black market cannabis pricing. And, it's, you know, once that happens, you know, and you've got prescribed cannabis products that are much, much better, legal, and as affordable as black market products that are easily accessible through one of many dedicated cannabis clinics, you know, most of the barriers to access get removed. The industry grows as a result. So that's going to, I mean, that's been a trend that's been happening last year, but that's going to continue and accelerate into this year. What I think will be different about 2021 is there'll probably be a lot more focus on clinical trials and trial results. So there've been, like, you know, some of the larger cannabis companies have been running clinical trials for a while. And they're at various stages of completion. But some of those, you know, phase two studies will start to wrap up this year, and we'll get some really, hopefully, great news stories out of that, which would be great. And those have a compounding effect, right? You know, clinical trial demonstrates that cannabis is effective for X, you know, that makes it more likely that patients will go to their doctors and ask about cannabis, which, and, you know, the whole thing keeps trundling along, which is nice. In terms of sort of regulation and policy stuff, there's a few big ticket items that are bubbling away at the moment that are set to be resolved by the middle of 2021. So we have this quite major and quite broad consultation process, this sort of review of import regulations for medical cannabis products that are brought into the country and quality standards. That review is also looking at the way in which medicinal cannabis products are compounded in Australia at the moment, and, you know, looking to maybe tighten that up. So that's significant. You know, what that might do, I'm not sure. You know, so we're still at the stage where the government is seeking public consultation, so, you know, people can go and tell them what they think they should do. You know, so the results of that won't be published for some time. But the government indicated last year that any changes that are made might come into effect in mid 2021. So it's possible that by June we might have new restrictions on how medical cannabis can be compounded, and that will probably have a significant impact in terms of the kinds of products that patients get prescribed. So, you know, if compounding gets tightened up really strictly all of a sudden, we'll probably see a lot of the brands or the product companies get an instant sharp sort of boost to their revenue, because a whole bunch of patients will move from compounded products onto sort of unapproved medicine products.
For the listeners that aren't familiar with compounded products,
I'm sorry.
Are you able to break that down for them?
Yeah.
That's all good, man.
Sure. Sorry, yeah, I can be a bit technical in some of my language, so I should try and be more
clear. No, go for the technicality.
So basically, compounding is a normal thing that happens all the time for a whole bunch of medicines in Australia. And basically, you know, if your doctor wants you to take a specific, you know, medicine, but you know, they need it to be at a dose that's different to the dose that is currently available for that product, or, you know, you're allergic to, you know, grapeseed oil, and that's the oil that's used in that product, and they want to use a different oil. Or, you know, there are many different reasons why doctors would want to basically, you know, make up their own version of a product, and it's done on a per patient basis. So the doctor goes, okay, you know, here's a prescription, and it's for, you know, this specific combination of ingredients in this dose, you know, and the patient takes that to a compounding pharmacy, and the pharmacy goes, yeah, okay, I can make that up for you, and they create that product for that patient and give it to that patient. So that's how compounding works. And the same is possible for cannabis. So, you know, a doctor can, depending on the state they're in, say, oh, you know, I want to write you a script. I'm going to write you a script for a compounded CBD oil, let's just say, you know. And they'll write out the instructions for, oh, I want it to be, you know, 100 milligrams per milliliter of CBD, you know, in a 50 milliliter bottle, you know, mixed with grapeseed oil, you know. And the patient takes that to the pharmacy, and the pharmacy creates the product and gives it to the patient. Fine. So that's normal and perfectly permitted. But the government has basically conceded that, you know, they have some concerns around the compounding of cannabis medicines being done not on a per patient basis, but maybe there are some compounding pharmacies that are making stuff in batches, which is not permitted. And there's also some other sort of areas of concern potentially around, you know, product quality and stability and that kind of thing. So basically the concern is, you know, what is meant to be an ad hoc, you know, one-off, you know, on an individual patient basis, custom sort of process might actually at the moment be more of a sort of, you know, manufacturing in bulk, but not being licensed to manufacture in bulk kind of situation.
Sure.
Does that sort of make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then if you're manufacturing in bulk, you know, and it's, you know, then, you know, you're making a lot of this stuff all the time, then, you know, the possibility that, you know, some of those bottles, you know, might not be stable, or you might degrade over time, or, you know, that maybe you're not, you know, your formulation isn't, you know, done in a way that's going to ensure that the product doesn't degrade. Or, you know, I don't know. There are some other, I'm not a pharmacist, as you can tell. But there are some concerns around that. So they're looking into it. And I reckon there's probably a lot of patients in Australia who are prescribed a compounded product, because compounded products are generally cheaper than the branded products. And they're cheaper because, you know, they don't have to be manufactured in a pharmaceutical grade, you know, sort of GMP, you know, sort of full blown facility like the other products do. So there's also a chance that it might have it put upwards pressure on prices for patients in the short term. But I reckon in the long term, I reckon it's probably a good thing.
So the compounding, a lot of the compounding would be done with international, like imported product. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, you know, compounding is, you know, you take some CBD powder and some grapeseed oil. I'm not a pharmacist, you know, mix them together, put them in a bottle, give it to the patient. And all of the ingredients, like the CBD and the THC, the cannabinoids that go into compounded product, all of that is imported because it's a condition of Australian cannabis manufacturing licenses that those companies can only supply material to certain access pathways, which don't include compounding pharmacies. Yeah.
So you mentioned the import products earlier, and perhaps the government or the regulators looking into certain regulations with regards to imports. Can we talk in a little bit about GMP and the differential between what a local Australian producer, what standards they need to meet to get their product to market, and what standards the imported product needs to meet?
Yeah. So at the moment, the situation is if you manufacture anything in Australia, a medicine, a vitamin, anything, a cannabis product, it has to be manufactured in a facility that has been ticked off by the TGA as meeting GMP quality standards. You know, so literally everything that you see, you know, in the pharmacy will be manufactured in a GMP facility. The And those products, medicinal cannabis products that are manufactured in Australia, also need to demonstrate that they comply with Therapeutic Goods Order 93, which is another sort of like, you know, additional quality standard for medicinal cannabis products. So both of those need to be adhered to for local manufacturers. But for imported products, they only need to comply with TGO 93, and they don't need to have been manufactured in a facility that has that is a GMP accredited facility. Now that's been a source of tension for some time, because naturally, you know, local companies are saying, well, hang on a second, you know, we have to jump through all these hoops to make sure that our products are, you know, the best that they can be. But these imported products that we're competing with don't need to meet the same standards, you know, and it's an unfair playing field, basically. And also, you know, it's a bit weird, right? Because if the government said, you know, we believe that everything manufactured in Australia should meet this quality standard because that's what we expect for Australians, but then they're letting in all of this stuff that doesn't meet that standard, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense, right?
No, that's crazy. Yeah. Now, you mentioned TGO 93. Both importers and domestic producers need to meet this standard. Is this about pesticides and fungus and pathogens,
heavy metals? Yeah, sure. Yeah. And also potency, sure. You know, so and labeling accuracy and stuff like that. So all of the, you know, all of the unregistered medicine, all the imported products should meet TGO 93, have to meet, are required to meet it. So, you know, I'm not too concerned about, you know, there being, you know, really shoddy, you know, medical cannabis products in Australia that are going to potentially harm people, you know, that seems unlikely, you know, which is good. But yeah, as I said, you know, it doesn't make much sense to require local companies to meet an even higher threshold while imported products are exempt.
Yeah, I mean, the overheads for the domestic producers are obviously going to be higher to build a facility that meets these GMP standards. So their competitors abroad, who quite often can be dealing with cheaper labor costs as well.
Yep.
But they also have these reduced overheads by not having to meet these standards by producing GMP standard facilities.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's nothing to stop. This isn't at all about stopping imports or being protectionist or anything like that, right? Like there are, you know, you look at a company like, say, Clever Leaves, for example, you know, it's a Latin American company that is able to produce, you know, GMP, you know, quality or GMP accredited material that can be exported to countries, including Australia. So, you know, it's not about, well, it is at the moment about importers versus exporters, but really it's about consistency and quality standards being consistent.
Sure.
You know, so the government's never going to say, okay, you know, the government's never going to do what Canada does and prevent companies exporting cannabis products to that country in violation of trade rules, which is what Canada's doing at the moment. Like Australia won't do that. You know, but hopefully we will end up in a situation where everyone's on the same playing field, and that playing field is of a higher quality standard than we have been in the past. Yeah.
Very interesting. Now, you mentioned Canada and the exports. I guess a lot of people listening won't be entirely familiar with the situation over there with regards to exports. Are you able to give us a little rundown of what the situation is there?
Sure. So you can export medical cannabis products from Canada, so long as the country you're sending it to allows them to enter the country. That's fine. Canada can't export any recreational cannabis products, or rather, it has chosen to not permit that, because that would, you know, that would really upset a lot of other countries around the world. Just fair enough. And recently, it's come to light that some companies have been trying to send their products, medical cannabis products, to Canada, you know, to compete in their medical cannabis market. But the story that I've read, which is, you know, from a reputable source, from MJ Biz Daily, who are like, you know, 10 out of 10, in my opinion, is that Health Canada, or the, I think it's Health Canada, their import agency, is basically just like not stamping the import approvals for those products.
Sure.
So Canada's allowed to export medical cannabis products all over the world, including to Australia, because we have a lot of Canadian products here. But it seems like someone somewhere in the Canadian bureaucracy is preventing products from being imported to Canada, which if this was a larger, if this was a bigger commodity, would be a really serious violation of international trade rules. And they'd be in front of the World Trade Organization. But I don't think anyone cares enough about medical cannabis to really to die on that hill, so it hasn't been a big issue yet.
Now, producers here in Australia, I'm sure it's very difficult to get a business to a profitable model. Do you feel that things with the growing market that you're forecasting, how far off are we from seeing some of these public companies really generating genuine profit?
Well, I don't know. I mean, look, I'm not like a finance guy, so I really don't have much of a sense for how profitable, most of these companies are. But I understand that none of them have turned a profit yet, which is, it's still early days. But, it does seem like they are, on average, incurring huge ongoing costs and generating really meaningless, not very meaningful revenues. And there's a lot of them. If you gave me $10 million and said you can start any business you want, I probably wouldn't start a cannabis company.
Yeah.
Just because it seems like a really difficult way to lose money at the moment. Yeah. At least in Australia. I think a few of the more sophisticated operators will do well in the long term. And part of that will be the continuing growth of the Australian market. And part of that will hopefully be other export markets opening up in a way that allows them to generate meaningful revenue, But I reckon, especially if you're talking about cultivating plants, look what's happening in Canada at the moment. So much excess capacity, companies selling massive glass houses for half of what they bought them for just a few years ago.
Well, that's happened here too.
And, at the same time, you've got, Colombia and Uruguay, really, really getting their feet underneath them in terms of large scale, low cost cultivation. You've got, Lesotho in Africa. You've got, Portugal. I don't know. I wouldn't go down that route personally, but then I'm also quite a risk averse person, believe it or not. When it comes to money and investments, so maybe I'm not the best person to ask necessarily.
But you are an investor in the space.
No, I don't hold any stocks.
No, okay.
I made a decision quite early on to not get involved with any of that.
Yep.
Partly because I'm not that interested in gambling on the stock market, and also partly just because the conflicts of interest it would present really challenging to manage,
Absolutely.
So I've stayed away from all that, thank goodness. But I reckon the commercial projects that I'm really interested in as far as the Australian cannabis industry goes, aren't necessarily the, large-scale cultivation, turn it into an unregistered medicine, send it to Germany, although that's a fine business model. We've got some really cool companies here that are doing that really well. But I'd be more interested in the medical science side of stuff, like developing, new novel drugs that are proven to treat specific conditions. Like, that's really cool to me. Setting up interesting and new ways of gathering, patient data. I think those are spaces where Australia does really well, historically, in biotech and medical science. Even though our government doesn't really invest in it that much at all, we succeed sort of nonetheless, to a greater or lesser extent. So,
very cool. So you mentioned the import side of things. There may be some movement on the regulations there. You're forecasting an increase in patient numbers. What else are you sort of predicting for this coming year?
I'm not sure of any particular milestones or events that I'm anticipating will create significant change in Australia this year, but there will be some unforeseen events that will kick things off. And also internationally as well. Like, I think, you know, with Biden now in the White House, you know, the Democrats controlling the House and the Senate, the potential for meaningful cannabis policy reform in the States has never been more real, you know. And, you know, whatever happens there, if anything happens in terms of federal policy change on cannabis in the US, that will have massive global implications, you know, because all of the major pharmaceutical companies, all of the major finance, you know, most major finance companies, these are all headquartered in the States. Facebook, Google, you know, these are American companies, and their cannabis policies and the extent to which they, you know, permit cannabis-related content on Facebook, or the extent to which they are prepared to invest in new cannabis-based drugs, you know, that's largely driven by the, you know, U.S. Federal U.S. policy, you know. So if something significant happened in the States, even if it was just decriminalization at the federal level, I think that would send a really strong signal to a lot of these larger corporations that, hey, we're actually not going to come knock on your door and lock you up if you get involved in the cannabis industry. And that would give them potentially the little push that they need to get into the sector. Now, you know, whether or not that's good for medical cannabis patients or not, I'm not sure. But it would be significant, you know.
I think we should bring up CBD over the counter. And this was something that was proposed last year. And we're in January now. We're almost at February. And it was predicted for February 1st, was it not? Was it? Yeah, around February. Is it going to meet the deadline, or where are we at on CBD over the counter?
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing to suggest that deadline will be missed. Come February, the schedules are amended, and we have this new Schedule 3 entry for CBD, which is great, you know, at 150 milligrams as well, which is a real surprise. And then the race is on, you know, and the race is on for companies to develop a new, you know, to get a drug to market, and then to prove that that drug is effective for treating a specific condition at that dose. You know, so it's the start of the race, not the end of it, for sure.
Yeah. Can you put some clarity for prospective patients into, I guess, the fact that February 2nd, pharmacies across the nation will not be stocked with CBD oils that are available over the counter?
Yeah, that's right. So it is unlikely that any Australian will be able to buy CBD over the counter at a pharmacy legally for at least another 2 years.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is, yes, there will be a new Schedule 3 over-the-counter sort of definition of CBD. But if you read that definition, it stipulates that the only products that will be made available behind the counter at pharmacies are products that have been registered as medicines, right? So in Australia, we have, you know, maybe, I don't know, 180 different medicinal cannabis products that are available to be prescribed to patients. And two of those are registered medicines, and that's Sativex and Epidiolex from GW Pharmaceuticals. So no other cannabis company has so far bothered to or managed to get their medical cannabis product registered in Australia yet. And that is also the case for, you know, low-dose CBD cannabis products. CBD was made a prescription-only medicine, so that's a Schedule 4 drug. So it went from Schedule 9, prohibited, to Schedule 4, prescription-only, in like 2015, I think, or 2014, I can't remember. So it's been 5 years, 6 years, since CBD has been technically a prescription-only drug in Australia. And the only CBD product that has been registered has been Epidiolex, and that was a few months ago. You know, so I don't want to be too much of a downer, but it's important to reiterate this point, because as you point out, right, so many people in Australia don't really understand the nuances here and are under the incorrect impression that it's now legal and will be available and that's fine. And, you know, people being disappointed when they find out their pharmacist won't sell them CBD is one thing. That doesn't bother me too much. But, you know, one thing that I'm concerned about is so many people believing that this stuff is legal and then allowing themselves to be taken advantage of by, you know, people selling them CBD oil on Instagram or whatever, who are able to say things like, oh, no, you know, CBD is legal now. Look, you can get it, you know, at the pharmacy, and therefore, you know, you should buy it from me, some, you know, random faceless, you know, Instagram account, you know, and sell people snake oil.
It's kind of been
already happening.
Yeah, for the last 4 years, it's been quite a large black market with imported CBD oils, and I think half the time it's not even what it's labeled to be. So that's a huge issue. And you mentioned the snake oil aspect of it, and you also mentioned people advertising on social media forums. We had our first fine handed out recently. Are you able to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, the advertising regulations are a bit tricky, a bit complex, perhaps. And if you're really interested in them, you know, you can go and read up on them. I won't necessarily bore you with the details, but basically the situation is the TGA says, look, you know, in Australia, we have rules against promoting prescription only or promoting certain classes of drugs to the general public. So, you know, you're not allowed to promote medicinal cannabis or the use of medicinal cannabis to direct to consumers in Australia. That's, you know, that's the rule, basically. Now, of course, you know, that hasn't stopped, like you say, plenty of people for a very long time doing exactly that. You know, and I think it's especially tricky when it's on social media because it allows people to hide behind, that, you know, often they're not disclosing who they are. And if they're not people who reside in Australia, then there's nothing the government can do, you know, because Australian law only applies to people in Australia. You know, they're not going to get Interpol after them, exactly. So that's one thing. But then, you know, on the other side, you know, like the medicinal cannabis industry in Australia, product companies, clinics, you know, a whole bunch of people have been for a while really flying in the face of those rules, I think. And there has been quite a long-standing tradition of pretty ballsy, you know, very obvious breaches of advertising regulations when it comes to medicinal cannabis. You know, which is a problem because, you know, some companies get tapped on the shoulder by the TGA and some don't, you know. Some companies, you know, say, oh, you know, they said we had to take this part of the website down by this date, you know, or else, but at the same time, our direct competitors over here, you know, they've had the same thing up. So, you know, so everyone, it's kind of created a lot of bad blood, and a lot of finger pointing, which wasn't helped by the fact that, you know, the TGA has a tendency to not invest the resources that it needs, to enforce the rules that they have created or to enforce the rules that they are tasked with enforcing, you know? Yeah.
Now, you mentioned quite early in the chat that you did some consulting and advising for foreign groups, learning about the Australian space. I was just curious, did you approach those groups or are they people that have found you within the Australian space?
Yeah. When I was getting started, like 2016, and I was doing consult because my background, like my professional background before I went to uni, was business to business sales.
Yep.
So, you know, I'd worked in call centers. That's the kind of work that I knew. You know, okay, get a list of companies. You know, call them, have a conversation, present your services, and that's what I started doing when I was when I got started in cannabis. It got me nowhere. The strategy just didn't work at all at the time. And so what I ended up doing was, you know, quite deliberately focusing on doing stuff that would generate inbound inquiries and inbound work as opposed to outbound, like me calling people, like people would call me. Mm-hmm. I started writing a whole bunch of stuff. You know, I said yes to every speaking opportunity. I managed to wrangle my way into a few international conferences. And then once you build up enough of a presence, I guess, or a profile, and, you know, and a decent reputation, you know, then, yeah, people started reaching out to me. And so like LinkedIn's great, you know, so you know, I get, you know, quite regularly contacted on LinkedIn or Twitter by people who are like, oh, hey, you know, love your work. You know, I'm from wherever, you know, would love to learn more about Australia. You know, do you want to have a chat? And that's how a lot of my clients tend to find me.
That's really cool. What is the right now in the cannabis space? What excites you? What's really the thing that's consuming you that you're investigating a lot?
Well, I've gone through a bit of a lull recently, if I'm being perfectly honest with you. I've felt like I've been losing a lot of my passion. Had been feeling like I'd lost some of my momentum for the last sort of few months or so, I guess.
I like that honesty. Thank you.
And what I've come back to recently is actually one of the things, like the reason why I got into cannabis in the first place was about you know, a strong sense of justice and the fact that I really care about reforming drug laws, you know?
Sure.
So I'm not sure where that'll lead me, but like that's going to be my project for this year is rekindling my passion for medicinal cannabis by reminding myself how it relates to drug law reform sort of more broadly and maybe even dipping my toe in that water to some extent, you know? Like I feel the medicinal cannabis system in Australia needs lots of work and there's tons of stuff to do. And it's fascinating, you know, it really is. But it's not that frontier that it was, you know, in 2015, 2016. The work that's required is very different work, you know? And it's more technical, it's more bureaucratic, which is still fun, you know, but it's not as zesty as it once was for me. So, yeah, I'm figuring it out as we go along. You know,
you don't have to answer this question if you don't want to, but how do you feel about adult use cannabis outside of the medicinal sphere?
Mm-hmm. I support it completely. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. So yep. That. So
100%.
So yeah. I guess you're sort of alluding to the concept that you would like to maybe explore that avenue a bit more and a bit of the fight, take the torch and take up a bit of that fight.
Potentially, it's something I'm really thinking about. Yeah, because it's tricky, right? Because I care deeply about medicinal cannabis and I care deeply for medicinal cannabis patients, and I understand people's concerns about the potential negative impact use might have on the medical system. You know, I get it. But at the end of the day, you know, like I think, you know, there's people being arrested for cannabis. There's people, you know, confronting the police and the justice system for cannabis possession. And that's fundamentally wrong. And, you know, something's got to be done about it at some point. And that point might be coming, you know. I think we're slowly getting to the point at which public support is, you know, approaching 50% for some kind of legal regulated adult use cannabis system. And once again, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not leaving medicinal cannabis at all.
Yep.
But it's something that I will be thinking about more and more this year.
Yeah, I quite like that because I feel as though people are now feeling a bit more comfortable with saying that they support adult use and that they hope for change. So for prominent people such as yourself and others that have been on our show, it's really important that you guys do speak up and sort of speak about the injustice of people who are being criminalized, locked up for simple possession, non-violent crimes. So yeah, thank you for being open with that.
Sure.
And yeah, I think I kind of agree. I think over the coming couple of years, we're gonna see a fair bit of movement in that side of things. I think the voice will only get stronger. You speak about the near on 50% public support that polls recently have shown in Australia. You just think about those numbers and how they've swayed over the past 4 or 5 years. It's a very significant sway. There's definite momentum going that way. So I guess it's not ridiculous to suggest that in the next couple of years, Australia may be ready to really discuss that quite openly. And I think it's really important that we get people such as yourself who are factually driven to speak about it. So thank you very much for discussing that, man.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I reckon it's coming, right? Because, like, you know, by 2025, before 2025, it's likely that a majority of Australians will favour the legalisation of recreational cannabis.
You know? I feel that.
And whatever that means to them, you know. And, you know, once you've got something approaching a majority, like, that needs to be resolved. It needs to be addressed in one way or another, you know. And there's so many different ways, you know, we could do that, you know. Like, that's the you know, one of the interesting things about these sort of frontiers, these sort of unexplored territories like medicinal cannabis was, you know, in 2015, when we were talking about legalizing medicinal cannabis, you know, all of the possibilities were there, you know. We're going to independent regulator, or, you know, do it through the TGA, or, you know, was home grow going to be allowed, or, you know, these are all, everything's on the table, you know, and that's a really exciting point in time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Reese, you're a man that's voice should be heard. I think people should be listening to you speak. People should be reading your content because you're somebody that clearly has strong moral grounds. You're intelligent. You're articulate. So are you able to tell people how they can check out some of your stuff?
Yeah, thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Of course, you can find me on the cannabis website. So that's cannabiz.com.au. And you can also find me on Twitter, RHYSCOHEN. You can also find me on LinkedIn. So those are the platforms that I frequent.
Very cool. Reese, it's been a pleasure having you on, mate. Really appreciate you joining us on Canter. We've known about you for a long time. For some reason, our paths haven't crossed up until now, but it's been a pleasure getting to speak to you, and we look forward to speaking in the future, man, because, like I say, you're a very prominent person in the Australian space. I think that you're a valuable person to the whole world community in cannabis, so I wish you nothing but the best for that, man, and, hope it just continues on for you, and I look forward to you being quite a loud voice in any social movements that may be occurring.
Yeah.
We'll see. Time will tell. Yeah, thanks, guys.
It's been an absolute
appreciate you having me on.
Thank you, bud.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Canter. Any guest views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and not necessarily those of the hosts. Canter strongly suggests listeners research local, state, and federal laws and regulations before conducting any cannabis-related activity.